is the theme that there are other tragedies that have befallen Am Yisrael over the course of history. And a number of the kinot deal with themes to do with the Crusades, themes to do with, as we've discussed on a previous occasion, the kinah Shalis Rufa Va'esh, which describes the burning of the Talmud in the streets of France. There are kinot that don't appear in our text, but which appear in other rites. We discussed a couple of years ago about Gerush Svarad, the expulsion from Spain, and we looked at kinot that exist in some of the Sephardi rites which address them. And each year I like us to look at another event in the course of Jewish history which looks at the destruction of Jewish communities over the course of time, Tisha B'Av being commemorative not only of the Churban HaBayit, but of all tragedies that have befallen Am Yisrael. And what I want us to spend a little bit of time today looking at is the 1929 Hebron massacre, which took place in August 29, so not far off 100 years ago, just over 92 years ago. And it's probably something that many people have heard about, but it's not necessarily something that we actually know a lot about. Hebron Yeshiva is in Yerushalayim. And the question always is, you know, we understand why the Mir Yeshiva is in Yerushalayim and such yeshivot, but why is Hebron in Yerushalayim? Why isn't Hebron in Hebron? The answer is that Hebron was in Hebron till 1929, when it was driven out and re-established itself in Yerushalayim, first in Meir Sharim, and then latterly in Givat Mordechai, which is where the main Hebron campus is today. But it was also prior to that, although there's still a branch in Meir Sharim. But the Hebron Yeshiva was originally a branch of Slobodka. It was part of Slobodka Yeshiva. And Slobodka was a very important yeshiva in Europe back in the day. There were two branches of the Musa movement. There was Navardok and Slobodka. So Navardok, they believed in Shiflut HaAdam. They believed in the way that you trained a person to improve their midot was by making them feel worthless. A person is worth nothing. They say that one of the things they used to do in Navardok was, you know, they'd send a person to go to the post office and ask for a bag of nails, so that the person behind the counter would laugh at them and scorn them and make them feel stupid. And that was a good way of improving your midot, was that you should feel stupid. And that in Navardok, everybody had a responsibility, you know, to do something for the yeshiva. If you were a new bocher, you'd be allowed to go to the post office once a week to buy the stamps for the office. I guess on that occasion you were allowed to ask for stamps, not for nails. To clean the floors of the Beis HaMedrash, you had to wait till you were an advanced bocher. That was that was a privilege for the advanced bochers, that they could clean the floors. That was Navardok. On the other hand, there was Slobodka. Slobodka believed that the way of improving your midot was by impressing upon you Gadlus HaAdam, that human beings have great dignity and that we have to behave in a way that reflects our dignity. And that is the best way of dealing with our midot. If you look on page 17, you've got a brilliant picture here of them, the Yeshiva Bochrim, at, you know, outside the yeshiva in Hebron in the 1920s. You know, you think of how does a yeshiva bocher dress today? Any self-respecting yeshiva bocher, you know, if you are not wearing black jacket, black trousers, white shirt, and a black hat, you're not serious. You know, if you went to a yeshiva in Yerushalayim today dressed in a straw boater, a bow tie, and a white jacket like that, you'd be laughed out of the place. But in Slobodka, that's how the Bochrim dressed. And you see pictures they used to take every year for fundraising purposes. You know, a picture of all the whole yeshiva. And the Rosh HaYeshiva and everything. The Rosh HaYeshiva didn't actually dress like this. The Rosh HaYeshiva dressed differently. But the Bochrim all dressed like they're all clean shaven. And they all, dressed really nattily, the latest trends and fashions like that. Not because they were obsessed with fashion, but because they believed in Gadlus Hadam, and that learning Torah is a profession, an occupation to be proud of. And you don't dress like a shloch. You dress like you're going into the office or, you know, somewhere important. That's what Chevron was. And that is what was destroyed as well. It was, you know, we've got pictures, you know, images in our minds of, you know, the old Yishuv, you know, and absolute poverty and then covered in dust and everything. They were very poor in Chevron Yeshiva. But, you know, they certainly dressed with dignity. And that was what was destroyed. I said, you've got these, you know, pictures of the Yeshivot, you know, where everything was, you know, all the Bochrim, you see all of them, you know, with their bow ties on and their bota hats. And that's the Gadlus Hadam of Chevron, which was destroyed. So what? Let's read a little bit about what happened in Chevron, certainly for Tisha B'Av afternoon. So we're not going to go through the whole of this. This is taken from Jewish Action, the OU's magazine, summer 2019. But certainly if you're looking for something appropriate to read this afternoon, then you can finish off this packet and you can read about this. Let's just read about the what's happened to Rabbi Moshe Gold, his experiences. It was on that Shabbat, the end of August 1929. And we should note, we're going to see that prior to that time, the relationship between the Jews and the Arabs in Chevron was reasonably good. So they had a good relationship. They didn't really have much space in the yeshiva dorms. And the yeshiva Bochrim would rent rooms in Arab homes. So you couldn't imagine doing that today in Chevron. No Jew would live with an Arab. They'd be frightened for their lives. But in those days, there was quite good relationships. People knew each other quite well, we're going to see. And yet, it all turned sour. And this is one of the things that has been very worrying in the latest round of violence in Eretz Israel. There's been lots of talk about, it's been a very long time since, you know, there were serious disturbances, you know, from Israeli Arabs, you know, in places like Lod and Yafo. Now, there's always been a bit of tension, but essentially the two populations have got on quite well together. And this is one of the things that has been very worrying. The latest round of violence is that people who lived together for so long in relative harmony, that's gone wrong. And of course, this is a repeated motif throughout the course of Jewish history. You know, we all know of stories from the Shoah of, you know, people who lived, families lived in the same roads, you know, for generations in Germany with their German neighbors. And all of a sudden, overnight, you know, friend turned to foe. And that's what happened in Chevron. So let's see this account. All night long, bloodthirsty Arabs ran through the streets in search of Jewish victims. My father and his roommates barricaded the doors and windows of the home in which they lived. At dawn, things seemed to quieten down. My father wanted very much to check on his Rebbe, Reb Moshe Mordechai Epstein, and daven with him. Although the Bachurim didn't hear anything going on in the streets, they were afraid that this was a ploy, and they warned my father not to go outside. My father, however, insisted on checking on his Rebbe and left the house. As it turned out, all the boys in the house where my father had been hiding were slaughtered. When an Arab attacked a Rebbe, a young Bocher threw himself onto his Rebbe, crying out, "You gave me life." The young man was killed while saving his Rebbe's life. My father reached the Rosh Yeshiva's house. The Arabs pounded the door of Rabbi Epstein's home with a battering ram. When the battering ram broke through the door, it hit him in the face and knocked out one of his teeth. As this was happening, the British chief of police of Chevron rode past them down the block. The rioters quickly dispersed. The yeshiva boys pleaded with him on Friday afternoon to prevent the probable violence. However, he did nothing to stop it. The police chief's wife even knew Rabbi Epstein. prior to the massacre, the Jews had very good relations with the Arabs in the area. And the yeshiva made sure everyone got along. Eliezer Dan Shlonim, one of the leaders of the Hebron Jewish community, was close friends with the local Arabs. Nevertheless, the Arabs slaughtered his entire family. Only his toddler son, Shlomo, survived. And there's a picture somewhere of that in the package. That's a picture of an aunt and the baby. At some point, my father was wounded. His body was thrown together with a pile of corpses. Later, a reporter trying to identify the murdered boys searched their pockets for identification. He came across my father's name and recorded it on the list of the murders. My grandfather, who was travelling in Europe at the time, noticed someone reading a newspaper with a headline publicising the terrible pogrom. He grabbed the newspaper and saw my father's name listed amongst the murdered. It was then that my grandfather suffered his first heart attack. Ultimately, he learned that my father had survived. But that's an account of what went on, you know, in the barricading themselves into the house, absolutely terrified of what was going to happen. If you turn to page 17, where the picture of the Bochrim is, again, we've got another account of what happened. That Shabbos morning, I walked from my lodgings to the Lazarovsky home. Looking out my window, I watched as carloads of Arab sheikhs travelled toward Maarat HaMachpelah, heading for the large mosque there. We davened Shacharit in the Lazarovsky home, too frightened to step outside. We read the Torah portion from a chumash, as we did not have a safer Torah with us. By the time we reached Musaf, everyone was terrified. We had a gut feeling that something terrible was about to take place. I could see the hill across the valley. Hordes of Arab peasants were tracking down the hill, heading straight for Hebron. There must have been hundreds of them, maybe thousands. They spilled into the street, stringing war songs. Mrs. Lazarovsky enjoined us to sit down and eat the Shabbat meal. But before she had even finished her sentence, blood-curdling shouts pierced the air. Thousands of bloodthirsty Arabs began stampeding towards the Jewish homes. We heard banging and more screaming. Residents ran outside, hoping to find shelter in the municipality's nearby health clinic. Unfortunately, once outside, they met up with the raged masses. As they ran back to the house, they tried catching the attention of the policeman who stood nearby, but the policeman didn't move a muscle. Meanwhile, the rioters had filled the house. They pounced on the head of the family and killed him with their knives. From our post on the top floor, we heard loud banging on the front gate. Had our turn come, the fear was tangible. Every person in the house shook uncontrollably. With superhuman strength, I hoisted a long, heavy bed on my back and placed it on the space between the front door and the inner door steps, leading up to the second floor, where we were all hiding. The Arab rioters refused to give up. They headed to the house next door. The Arab landlord lived in that house. They wanted to go up to his roof, jump onto our roof, and break into the house that way. Without losing a moment, I jumped from our roof to the Arab landlord's roof and began speaking convincingly, begging him not to acquiesce to their request. Using the little Arab that I knew, I managed to communicate with him. He agreed not to let the mob into his house. Okay, so you had righteous Arabs at that time because the relationships had been good till that time. His children, however, did not follow their father's example. They screamed out to the mob, "There's a Yahud here, there's a Yahud here." I stood near the Arab's window trying to figure out what to do. The Arab mob noticed me and brought their hatchets down on the door. The Arab landlord assured me, "You've nothing to worry about." The argument between my Arab and the mob intensified. The landlord told me to find a hiding place. I looked around. One of the pits used for household needs in his home seemed to be an excellent hiding place. The opening led to a place that was something like a cellar. I moved aside the boards that covered the opening and crawled inside, replacing the boards after me. One of my friends had somehow managed to enter the Arab's house as well. When he couldn't find me, he began to worry. Again, this is history repeating itself. Now, we've all read reports of, you know, Jews hiding in the sewers, you know, during the Shoah. It's just history repeating itself time and again. When he couldn't find me, he began to worry. I removed some boards and told him to join me. Then another escapee arrived and another. There were now four or five of us hiding in the pit. The pit was a long underground passage that ran under the street. We continued walking, the sounds of the crazed mob right on top of us. We had also heard ear-splitting shrieks and cries. After waiting in the pit for a few hours, we realized that the storm had abated. We decided to leave our hiding place and return to the Lazarovsky's home. There was not a living soul on the street. The Shabbos table was still set. Mrs. Lazarovsky's two sons had been murdered. one of their young daughters, Devorah, and her father-in-law, Reb Aryeh Leib Gitalevsky, were also murdered. Three generations at once. So that is three of their children and three generations at once all being murdered. In actual fact, we've got a slight link with the Hebron massacre. Ben Dov Selaznik, one of our regular mitpalalim, his great-great-uncle, Yisrael Shlomo Zelig Volensky, went to the Hebron Yeshiva in 1922. He was born in 1902 in Kosovo. And he was one of the martyrs of the Hebron massacre. And if you look on page 20, we've got just the last paragraph pointing out that, you know, this massacre was, the toll was very much felt by Chutz La'aretz. You know, there weren't Israeli bochrim in those days. In those, you know, nowadays you have Israeli Shivot, and most of the Talmidim in Shivot are Israelis. There are lots of people from Chutz La'aretz, but mostly Israelis. Of course, everybody in those days would come from Chutz La'aretz, from Europe, but also from America. Now, from Europe, I don't think it was necessarily such an enormous thing to go to Hebron. You know, it was a long way away, but, you know, you were very often poor in Europe, so you were poor in Hebron. In Eretz Yisrael, of course, there were wealthy people in Europe, but, you know, it wasn't, you know, perhaps the jump, the dissonance wasn't so great. America was the golden Medina. People were just starting to make it. Of course, you know, there was great poverty in America in the early part of the 20th century. America then wasn't like the Upper West Side or the Five Towns or New Jersey is today. But nevertheless, you know, you'd made that shift. You'd gone from Europe to America, you know, to find a new life. And then there was a big question. It was a very big thing to send your children to Eretz Israel to learn in European conditions again. That was a very big thing. These people, even those Talmidim who weren't killed, were heroic. Page 20 points out that a special place is occupied by the American contingent, who received a double portion of the cup of tragedy from which we drank at the end of 5629. From the land of gold and silver they came to the city of the patriarchs in order to dedicate their best years to the formation of their characters. What report did they hear so they came? A combination of the two words, Slobodka and Hebron. They heard and they came, and they dedicated themselves with all their ability to the great task of improvement, Aliyah, in order to return to their native land suffused with Torah and Yira, to bring light and warmth to their surroundings, to awaken the hearts of the young to follow in their paths with great dignity and great strength. More than once it seemed that with the smiles on their face they must have recognized the bliss that would be their future life. So did they grow and flourish, blossom and bear fruit on the foundations of Torah and Yira, flowers of grace, nobles of Israel, in whom is our glory and our pride. And suddenly, in the middle of the sunshine of the day, the axe was waved. The feller had come up. There is no word in the mouth, and no utterance on the tongue. Ki ein mina bilshoni, hein Adonai yadata kula. But lo, O Lord, you know it all together. So there's no kinah that I'm aware of written in memory of the victims of the Hebron massacre. We're going to look at one of the Anglo-Jewish kinot today. We're going to look at the kinah on page 171 in the Rosenfeld kinot. It's not in the other editions. It's the kinah for the Boppart and York martyrs of 1190. So we all know who the York martyrs were. And I remember as a kid always thinking it was very funny. Boppart. What a funny name was Boppart. Nobody ever knew who Boppart was. Who were the Boppart martyrs? So there doesn't seem to be a place called Boppart, but there's a place called Boppard in central Germany with a Dalet or a D at the end. And in 1179, there was a blood libel in Boppard. And that, Lichora, is the martyrs of Boppard, which was commemorated. There was also in the 1190s, I think 1198, there was also a massacre in Boppard. It's interesting how, I don't know who Menachem Ben Yaakov was who wrote this Kinah. It's interesting that what's happened in York and what's happened in Germany, you know, even in those days there was a link between them, even though it was a long way apart. And both of them were mourned. Of course, in York, there were Baalei HaTosfot at the time of the York martyr and of the York massacre. And obviously in Germany, there were also Baalei HaTosafot. So this is the Kinah on page 171 being read for us by Roland.
But the Tarpi Kerek was the Bayer, the Lati, Tovima Shebano to Khalib.